Nomi Prince is joining the Guadalajara Geopolitics podcast, and well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
You've written a number of best-selling books, the latest being All the President's Bankers, and you are now writing a new book called Artisans of Money. You have a long CV, and I invite listeners to learn more about you at nomiprinz.com. But early on, you worked on Wall Street and for Goldman Sachs, and I'd like to just start by asking you briefly, what made you do a 180? What was it that spurred you to put yourself on the right side of history by becoming a whistleblower and speaking truth to power after working for the big banks?
Oh, thank you. That's a really good question. Ultimately, it became an issue of my own moral compass that I think when I first started banking, even before I got to Goldman Sachs, just out of school, I didn't have any idea really what banks did, as most of us who joined the industry didn't, especially at the time. And through the years, I developed a bigger idea of what banks do and also what banks did change very negatively, particularly at the end of when I was there and towards the Goldman years. And I didn't think there were enough people from the inside who were really explaining what was going on to the outside. When I quit Goldman in early 2002, it was sort of before there was a lot of focus on negativities of Wall Street relative to the main economy outside of, you know, academics and economists and so forth. It wasn't so much a mainstream conversation. And so I thought that I needed to contribute to that conversation, and and also a lot of things that I saw weren't particularly savory, and increasingly so over the years. And so finally I decided it was time for me to get out, which was actually right after 9/11. I was down in New York on 9/11, so there was a bit of an also a life-changing moment as well for many of us being down there. And all of those things together caused me to leave the industry and speak about the industry. And really, the industry has gotten even worse since then with respect to what it can cause to the rest of the world in terms of economic failings and financial speculation that's negative to regular people and so forth. So,
well, I'm glad that you made that change and you provided us with all of this vital information. I'd like to focus now a bit on Mexico, which you've been discussing lately with your piece on Chris Martensen's Peak Prosperity. I followed Peak Prosperity for a while, but it wasn't until after a piece that I actually became a member, because I find the information so useful. And you also were at Mexico City recently talking at the Aspen Institute. And I'd like to talk about, for example, in Chapter 16 of All the President's Bankers, you discussed Latin America in the 1980s. When junk loans were sold to the third world and threatened to implode not only Latin American economies, but also damage U.S. banks. And in the end, governments and taxpayers basically ended up footing the bill, and risk was socialized while Wall Street took the profits. Goldman Sachs had Clinton bail out Mexico in the 90s. And so today, looking at Mexico, are we looking at a sequel of the events of the 1990s? How do you see Mexico and its economy today?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, with respect to Mexico and Latin America in general, a lot of circles in history that come back to this extension of debt, whether whether it was through bank debt or through debt to the government or debt right now in terms of corporate loans, that have gone through the United States financial system in particular, also Europe as well, of course, into the Mexican financial system. And over the years, you know, the bailouts that happened in the 80s happened largely because banks really were expanding beyond their any sort of old conservative rules or regulations as to what they would and the terms they would assign to debt dumped on Mexico and Latin America. And that was a decision they made. They ultimately, those debts were not going to be easy to be repaid, and as a result, the banks did ultimately go in the 80s for the Brady Bond situation within the Bush and the Reagan administrations, and then in the 90s, as you mentioned, with Clinton, all of a sudden the banks had a friend in Robert Rubin, who was a Treasury Secretary for Clinton, who had been the co-CEO of Goldman Sachs, which just happened to be one of the major banks at that time, who had also speculated within Mexico in terms of throwing capital in at things and then taking it out when it was unprofitable to them, but then getting bailed out by the U.S. government and leaving Mexico in a terrible state in terms of its financial system, with many local banks imploding, with a lot of debt to be repaid that was expensive, and creating this fractured financial system into which many foreign banks began operating in Mexico, and also as a result of NAFTA, so that today Mexico has over 65% or so, I have the slides and the exact numbers on my website, of capital basically controlled by foreign banks, 83% of bank assets controlled by foreign banks. And so when you have that situation, it becomes worse when there is a potential fallout than it was even before, into the bailout situation of the 1980s or the currency and financial crisis in Mexico of the 1990s, because now you have a situation where foreign banks own a much higher proportion of the capital that flows into and will flow out in problems of Mexico than you had before. So getting back, in a historical answer to your question, yes, I do think that right now Mexico is in a more precarious position, as well as a potentially repeat position of what happened in the 80s and the 90s, specifically because now there's also this added layer of a very heavy historical proportion of foreign banks operating with Mexico. Foreign banks do not have an allegiance to local economies. It's not what they're there for. They're there to take from local economies, to expand their interests into local economies. But at the moment that things don't go well, or they feel like removing that capital and putting it elsewhere, or there's that pressure from the international capital markets or speculators, it leaves very quickly. And then that leaves Mexico and the financial system in the greater whole.
Yeah, and that was the other point I was going to make. And I found it interesting when I was reading your articles about how much the percentage of the banks that are owned by it's the majority that are owned by foreign banks. And like you say, in a crisis, I guess the banks would run dry and all these banks would take their money out. And what would you say, perhaps for people who live in Mexico, it would be smart, I guess, what do you do in such a situation for the everyday person? Do they split their savings accounts between, having one foreign one account in a foreign-owned bank and then another account in the local Mexican bank? And I guess the idea would be to support the local Mexican bank and the local economy versus these foreign accounts. What do you think an average person should do?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's something for the average person to think about, particularly people that, it doesn't even matter, but people in local communities can contribute some of their savings or their money into local banks. They're the banks that are, more prevalent but domestic in their cities and so forth. Because as you said, and as is true, and I advocate this in the United States as well for people, the banks that, and one has to do a bit of the homework in terms of, making sure these banks are pretty intact in terms of their own capital and how they operate. But to the extent that they're, fairly solid, supporting local banks, community banks, national banks, is a way to keep capital in the country. And also to use that capital for local endeavors and infrastructure and job creation, rather than have it be used as effectively speculative betting chips on the international table, which is what happens when it's provided, when those deposits or that savings is provided to the foreign banks. And also the way foreign banks operate, they tend to leverage or use the money that they have in their grasp in order to speculate in anywhere else in the world, in derivatives markets and all sorts of other types of exchanges that might have nothing and usually have nothing to do with the local economy. And so in a way, that's what people are supporting when they're supporting the foreign banks. Now, that said, of course, it's easier to find those foreign banks. I mean, I go to Mexico frequently. As you mentioned, I was just there speaking at the end of August. And it's far easier to use and find the large foreign banks because they do have the capital to be on lots more corners, and to provide a lot more visibility for themselves and services from that perspective. So it all seems easier, and so a lot of people do have their finances tied up with these institutions. But I do advocate using those institutions if you need to, if that's where your mortgage is, if that's where certain bills are being paid, from a practical standpoint. But yes, splitting out the money into local banks, which also in Mexico tend to offer even greater interest on savings and deposits than some of the major banks. I mean, people can do this work for themselves in terms of their favorite local bank, but often, and this is the case in the States as well, you actually get a better deal for keeping your money with a smaller bank than keeping it with a larger bank.
And speaking of a local bank, what are your thoughts on the power that the Fed has over the Bank of Mexico and the proposal to monetize silver in Mexico? Because I personally have a silver account at Mexican billionaire Hugo Salinas Price's Banco Azteca, and he was a proponent of the bill to monetize silver, which was apparently rejected by, the Bank of Mexico, who was afraid of the Fed. And so I guess it's assumed that they were afraid to be so bold because of the Fed. But my guess is the Fed probably warned them directly never to dream of monetizing silver in Mexico. What do you think?
Well, I think the Fed doesn't want any country to monetize silver or gold globally, and the reason for that is the minute any form of country or local national finance sovereign financial system is trying to take it upon themselves to value hard asset like silver or gold, it becomes a sort of chip away at the armor that the Fed really has around its policies, which are predicated on, on the dollar, on sort of a fiat currency, on a currency backed by sort of pledges and printing money, and the reserves of, the U.S. banks, which are effectively money that's placed at the Fed behind the money that the Fed prints, but the Fed pays those banks to buy the assets that it then gives back to the Fed. So there's this whole sort of circular system that is not predicated on anything external like a hard asset. So that's why the Bank of Mexico would have been afraid. That's why the People's Bank of China, which tries, is trying to and has an element of monetizing gold within their currency, has this sort of back and forth, I'm sure, with looking at what the Fed thinks or doesn't think or cares or doesn't care, depending on how they're doing, because the Fed is so prevalent in terms of global policy. The Fed's more prevalent in terms of global policy in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis than it even was beforehand, because now it's really jumped front and center, not just as the Reserve Bank that is behind the largest global currency, but also the one that dictated the policy from the get-go of reducing rates to zero, or getting there throughout the world, of a currency battle where other currencies are weakened relative to the dollar and so forth. So anything that changes that dominance in policy, again, like a monetizing of silver or gold, gets in the way of the power of that policy. But that said, and a couple of things I said about the Bank of Mexico when I was there is that, to a large extent, in order to have your own country as secure as possible financially, which is really technically your job, you should ignore stuff like this. And you should, and that's in anything from interest rates to so forth. When I was there, and I had a lot of questions from the press about whether the Fed was going to raise rates and should the Bank of Mexico wait until the Fed raises rates to decide what they're going to do and so forth. And my answer at the time and remained is no, it should not wait. It should do what it needs to do for the country regardless of what the Fed's doing, because the Fed wasn't going to raise rates, as I said in August and as they did not do in September, nor will the Fed raise rates in December for various reasons. So it is up to the Bank of Mexico to be a little less codependent, not least because Mexico does have a large economy, is a major trading partner of the U.S. and so forth, than to worry about what the Fed thinks. But then I think all central banks should do that. We might have much more stable economies throughout the world. So,
and I've spoken previously with Guillermo Barba of Forbes Mexico, and he's mentioned things on his blogs, some of the silly things that the Bank of Mexico does, like they've been purchasing gold and then they haven't had it physically. You know, it's off somewhere in England. Meanwhile, other countries are seeing the risk of the situation globally, and they're bringing the gold back to hold in their own countries, while Mexico, for some reason, holds many tons abroad. And speaking of currencies, what are your thoughts on the peso, which reached historic lows in terms of the dollar, which went to 17 pesos to a dollar? And, you know, I can think of an example locally here. My favorite local organic store, which is probably the biggest in Guadalajara, and they told me that they have at the moment stopped importing products because of the super high exchange rate. And I guess the reason is because of the flight to safety that around the world people are flying to the dollar and temporarily boosting it. What's your take on the peso in the near future?
Well, first, it's very interesting what you say about your local food place, because the very fact that it's not able to afford to buy products that are made outside of Mexico also hurts the exports of those countries. And I imagine one of those is the U.S. So you have this weird situation where, you know, by virtue of the high dollar and the low currencies throughout the rest of the world, actually that hurts U.S. exports, which is something completely lost on U.S. politicians, I might add. But that's kind of besides the point. I think that, you know, in terms of the peso, and this kind of goes back to the Bank of Mexico as well, you know, to one extent, the peso, as well as other countries, are victim of the high dollar. And part of the high dollar thing is kind of different from what historically should be happening to a currency, which is that, you know, when we've created as much debt in the country as we have since the financial crisis in such a short period of time, and we have rates at zero, there's really no technical reason why the dollar should be as strong as it is from the sheer standpoint of classic economics. However, the reason it stays strong is, yes, it's prevalent because the Fed was the purveyor of this policy, first and largest in the world, of reducing rates to zero and of you know, unleashing the sort of currency wars, and driving other currencies lower, and then complaining that you know, countries are devaluing their currency, which again is bizarre. Mexico is not trying to devalue the peso to the extent that the U.S. believes, for example, the Chinese are trying to devalue their currency. But whatever the case, the result is that it's harder to, you know, as you said, in Mexico to buy products on the outside. It's also harder, and this goes to a larger economic and financial situation and potential problem for Mexican corporations that have borrowed in U.S. dollars in the past, and at the low rates that were available through U.S. borrowings as well as through European borrowings, that it becomes harder to repay those corporate loans or those corporate bonds because their profits are in pesos, which have been reduced in value relative to their interest expenses, which are in dollars, which have increased in value. And so that creates another, you know, bigger problem in terms of just the finances of Mexican corporations as well, not just your local one, but also, you know, local ones all throughout the country, I'm imagining as well. So if I were the Bank of Mexico, as I said when I was there, I would, you know, I would not necessarily be using reserves to boost the peso, because in today's global speculative capital markets, that's generally a losing proposition. You're just basically running down your reserves to try and fight, you know, potential capital flight or negative trades against your currency, and that just never works. It's a bad use of reserves, although it is what the Bank of Mexico decided to do, I think, about 6 weeks ago, to use 8.3 or 6 billion or so in worth of dollars to back the peso over the next couple of months. And obviously that hasn't been working, but that was the policy they decided. A better policy would, again, be to ignore the Fed and to raise rates, or at least make sure that rates aren't reduced in terms of you know, the general interest rate in Mexico, the interest rate that people then get if they do keep savings in Mexico, the interest rate that international capital would get if it was invested in Mexico, and so forth. So, I mean, that's really the best way to fight the currency devaluation, is to keep the interest rates higher. That seems to be what the Bank of Mexico isn't thinking of doing, but that would be the better way to do it. Mm-hmm.
And, well, we're running out of time, and I'd like to ask the question that I always, the final question that I ask my guests, because my focus here is on the next generation, you know, of high school and university students. And I'd like to ask you, what words of wisdom would you have for the next generation who are entering a world on the verge of another perhaps great crisis, and in terms of their education and who they're going to be? I mean, what words of wisdom would you have? Because I hope more people would think critically and follow, the type of work that you're doing and that sort of thing. So your final thoughts, words of wisdom.
Well, I do think, following work that's outside of the main discourse is I think useful to everyone, particularly to students, because there's so much access now to information, through the internet, through, all the various, technological, devices and so forth, to get information and to think for yourself. And I think, thinking for yourself is huge in terms of being a student or just being a human, because I think that gives you more information to make those sorts of decisions. And I think going forward, because the world is so volatile, because governments are volatile, because financial systems are volatile, because that means that larger companies will be more volatile and be more likely to not hire or hire and then fire loads of people in more ways, that students have this opportunity to kind of connect into the world outside of these main mechanisms. And I'm not saying don't work for the government. I'm just saying that, there are so many ways today to, to create sort of independent businesses through technology. That doesn't mean it has to be an app, or it doesn't mean it has to be, the next Google, but whatever the interest is, whether it's a nonprofit interest, whether it's, finding a way to match up loans in the particular area in which you have interest to individuals who have interest and don't want to necessarily support things through their banks, but may want to support activities outside of the main financial systems. I think that's where students really have a lot of opportunities to also, that means, sort of follow your heart as well, is to find ways outside the main systems to make a mark in the world.
And to fight for, truth and justice, known for a better society. And as I like to put it for you, standing on the right side of history. Well, thank you, Nomi Prinz, for your time. I urge everyone to visit nomiprinz.com and go out and get all the President's Bankers. I have a copy here with me, as well as your previous titles. And I can't wait for Artisans of Money. Do you have a... perhaps, do you know when that's going to come out? You're ready right now?
I don't, actually, because I have to start writing it. But no, I'm in the process of getting, in fact, I'll probably have another couple trips to Mexico, so and many other places. So I'm imagining at the end of 2017 or the beginning of 2018, it will actually come out.
Okay, well, in the meantime, everyone can read your 3 or 4 books that you've put out already.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you can join us again sometime in the future. And, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you very much.